Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
Everybody, this is the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors, show number 102, and this is November 15th, 2021. I'm your host, Tom Riedel. Brief intro to today's show. We're having on author R.J. Johnson, who wrote Dream Slinger, and you'll be with us shortly, about 15 minutes after the hour. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, the Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriedel.net. That's thomasriedel.net. You find it in the blog section, and the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for the Writer's Lounge. Find me on Twitter at TomRiedel56. And our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on a show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line and we'll get back to you. A special note, we can also now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to TuneIn and ask her to play the Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. Upcoming authors on the Writer's Lounge on Monday, November 29th, 2021, that's 2 weeks from tonight, we'll have on author Nancy Kilgore will be here with her novel Bitter Magic, which was inspired by the true story of Confessed Witch. That's right. Confessed Witch, Isabel Gowdy. It's a step back into the 17th century Scotland. On December 13th, bestselling author Jonas Saul will be with us, and he'll talk to us about his years as an author and his book, A Murder in Time, a time travel thriller. Hope you'll take time in these exciting upcoming shows to tune us in. And we are now booked up into the new year. So if you want to get in your interview here on the show and have your book reviewed, get those into the email, writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. Now we go on to the next segment of the show, and it's always interesting to me to talk about writers' topics, and authors often go to interesting playgrounds to find plots for their books, and one place that maybe our guest author tonight ventured to would be to the wonderful world of UFOs and government cover-ups. Always a very interesting subject, and over the years, Hollywood, the National Enquirer, and now numerous online sites have saturated our minds to the point where we brush away these fantastical stories to the point where we mock and laugh at them. But now, maybe we're closer to moving these stories from out of the fiction pile into the fact file. From recent reports, which includes the New York Times, there seems to be credible evidence that some of these UFOs are real, as evidenced by Air Force pilots, and there is, according to many, a real government cover-up. In the five-minute clip I will play you, you will hear a YouTube promo for UFO docu-series, UFO cover-ups, which is streaming on Paramount Plus. You'll hear UFO enthusiast John Greenwald and director Mark Monroe. After the clip, we'll be back to introduce RJ Johnson to the Writers Lounge. Be right back.
In 2017, a bombshell New York Times article revealed the U.S. government had been secretly tracking UFOs for years.
And now the explosive new docuseries UFO delves deeper to expose the cover-ups and alien encounters that could change the way you think. Let's take a look.
When I look in the sky at night, I've got the knowledge that there's something out there.
The New York Times story changed everything.
Whether you accept it or not, some people actually saw this stuff.
Imagine if it was acknowledged that UFOs exist.
Our own divisions would suddenly feel so much smaller.
The world needs to get ready for what's about to happen.
Director Mark Monroe and UFO enthusiast John Greenwald join us now from the U.S. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
John, if I could start with you. You've been seeking answers from the government since you were 15. What got you interested?
I wish I had a great story for you where I had an experience or encounter or something like that. I am driven purely by curiosity. And I started when I was 15 years old. I never thought 25 years after that I'd still be going strong, but I've seen enough to realize there's something there. They're covering something up and I haven't let it go.
What have you seen?
You know, there is ample evidence, and I'm talking reams of official U.S. government documents that proves beyond any shadow of a doubt that there absolutely is a UFO cover-up. Now, a UFO cover-up of what? Well, that's the question that all of us want to answer, and that's one that we don't have an answer to yet. But there's enough evidence to show us that we need to keep pushing for answers, because this is not as easily explainable as the U.S. government wants us to believe. There's absolutely something much deeper going on.
Mark, did working on the series, the docuseries, change your views on the existence of UFOs?
Well, I think it opened my eyes. I think for so long in our culture, the whole topic has been kind of ridiculed and mocked, and you only see it really on the covers of the tabloid magazines, the National Enquirer, or big Hollywood kind of productions, X-Files and Steven Spielberg movies. And so seeing it on the front page of the New York Times, just seeing UFO on the front page of the New York Times, and this reveal that the government had actually been studying for quite some time, for many years, without telling us, in fact, denying that they were doing so, I think that's a big story. And it certainly gets a lot of attention on the topic. And without that attention, I don't think we're going to get anywhere. Mm. So I thought it was remarkable.
Mark, it's still not unusual, though, for UFO sightings to be ridiculed. Do you think your series lends credibility to the idea that they need to be taken seriously?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I do think, obviously, differentiating between, you know, kind of crackpots and credible sources is the big issue here. And 95%, probably more, of what happens in the skies can be explained. But there is, as John says, there's clear and ample evidence that something is happening, something is going on that we have not been able to explain. And the government now has stated so. You know, maybe with the U.S. government, maybe with a pretty flimsy 9-page kind of summarized report, but nevertheless, they don't have answers. They know that UFOs have been cited, that there are things out there that cannot be explained.
John, you've accessed over 2 million pages of government documents under the Freedom of Information Act. You've seen those documents, but have you actually seen something in the sky that could not be explained?
Well, me on a personal front, no, but I can tell you that I just passed 3 million pages that I've received from the U.S. government. And when you talk about the UFO records, there are a huge stack of military witnesses and credible witnesses that have come forward with encounters, seeing things, photographing things, even taking videos of them, of craft that they cannot explain. Now, that's not me saying they can't explain them. That's the United States military saying, we have no idea what these are. And that to me, this goes back to 2019, when I got the Navy to go on the record and say these three videos that everybody's been seeing in the media, when they went on the record with me and said that they truly did not know what they were. That was a moment that I fell off my chair, and I don't fall off my chair often. And for them to really say, hey, look, we are clueless on what's going on and we need to investigate it, that was a big step in showing that this phenomena is not only real, but it is just not solvable at all.
Better find yourself a good, stable chair to watch this new documentary series. UFO is streaming right now on Paramount Plus. Mark and John, thanks so much for your time this morning. Appreciate it.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that clip. A little food for thought as we go into the program here. Of course, we're talking about a fiction book that RJ had written, and that's more of a factual account of what's happening out there, but I think it ties in really nicely with what we're going to talk about today, and that would be the main event, the book Dreamslinger by RJ Johnson. Here's my review about with Dreamslinger. To his family, friends, and fiance, Alex McCrae was reported to have been killed in action. 6 years pass, and then one day he shows up at his dad's house where the two have an emotional reunion. The two then decide to embark on a rock climbing camping trip. During the trip, Alex's father hands over a stone necklace, which Alex remembers from his youth. As he remembers it, the stone had mystical powers, which miraculously healed his best friend's injuries after a bad fall. He had somehow forgot about the incident, but while holding the stone, it brought back the memory in vivid detail. Unknown to the two, another man, Rupert Klein, has evil intentions and limitless resources. Klein seeks out the two, kills Alex's father in an effort to gain possession of the mystically powerful stone. Alex vows to avenge the death of his father and enters into a quest with his best friend to hunt down Klein. He soon learns that his stone isn't the only one in existence and that the powers contained within them could change the world. It becomes apparent that the stones may have originated from an alien civilization, and Alex, his fiance, and their pursuers will have to come to grips with a very real and humanity-changing possibility. And RJ Johnson creates compelling characters and action scenes that gripped me and kept my eyes to the page. The Rupert Klein character is as diabolical and evilly addicting as any ever written. The pace of the story flows nicely, and the surprise at the end will ensure that I will continue reading this series. The humor is very well put into the story, and the action scenes was also very entertaining, especially between Alex and his best friend. If you're into UFOs and those kinds of mysteries, you'll love this one. And now it is my pleasure to welcome RJ Johnson to the Writers Lounge broadcast as we reach out here to push the magic button to open the doors to the Writers Lounge, and hopefully this works. Gotta love technology. And there should be RJ. RJ, are you there?
I am, Tom. Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for that very kind review.
Yes, my pleasure. It was an interesting read, and I really enjoyed it. So Why don't you tell us about yourself and what and who inspired you to write stories?
Wow, that is a long question. Well, my name's RJ Johnson, as you introduced me. I actually grew up in Southern California here, where I worked in radio broadcasting for about the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. The story where it took place, where I set the scene, is actually my hometown of Big Bear, California. It's kind of a ski resort-esque, you know, away from it all type of town. And I took a lot of inspiration for that, for my setting from that, as well as other types of, you know, landmarks and places around Southern California. You know, I think when I first started wanting to write is when my second grade teacher, she assigned our class a little short story, and she liked it. She liked mine, the one I wrote, so much that she bound it together in kind of a little book. I still have it, as a matter of fact. And I illustrated it, and she typed it all up and bound it for me and gave it to me as a present. And that really is what inspired me to be the author or be a writer when I grew up.
That's neat. That's really, really cool. When especially when a teacher recognizes you, and I could tell you a similar story with myself. And it's really nice when they do that, and it really helps you in the future as you continue on your endeavors to be a best-selling author, as they say. But Dream Slinger dives into the question of extraterrestrials, and as one of your characters mentions in the book, they say, here's the quote, "The whole idea of aliens is fascinating to me and all, but we've never had any proof." So, RJ, what do you think? Will we ever make contact?
Wow.
And you probably listened to that clip that I played at the beginning of the show.
I did. And you know what? So you have to understand, I wrote this a long time ago. This book, this manuscript, I first finished in about, I want to say, 2012. Mm-hmm. So before that, we didn't have the video. We didn't have the GoFast video, the gimbal video, I think it's called, of those things that you would see, you know, recorded from the Nimitz fighter pilots.
Yes.
My biggest problem with UFOs, honestly, is the fact that, one, like I said in the book, you know, there's no, you know, evidence of them anywhere, no megastructures that we've been able to detect, no contacts, no nothing like that. And then also the mere physics and the distance of it all. Like, unless there is some undiscovered part of physics that we just do not know about or understand, it's very, very unlikely that we would see, you know, an alien civilization come out here. Or conversely, if you've ever heard of von Neumann machines, which is the self-assembling robots, if there were an alien civilization out there, even if they beat us by, you know, 100,000 years, which is nothing in galaxy universe-spanning time, this entire galaxy would have already been filled up with those self-replicating robots. So we're left with the idea of, are they really out there, or are they out there and we just don't rate a visit, or are they out there or we are in some kind of zoo, or are they out there and they're actually making contact with us now? And honestly, the way I feel about it, especially in the last few years with a lot of the revelations that we've seen, there is something out there, and it's not just me. This is like high-powered, you know, people in the Navy, like the clip brought up, real solid witnesses that are saying this stuff is not normal. This is not anything human beings can create, and that's just the fun and mystery of, I think, those UFOs. I don't know if they're necessarily aliens or if they're you know, trans-dimensional or whatever it is. All I know is that there is a lot of stuff that we cannot explain.
Yes, I think the catchphrase here would be, we can't explain what's out there. I'm also a ghost hunter. I go and investigate homes, and they ask me, well, do you believe in ghosts? Well, I believe there's something there that I can't explain. I'm not saying that I believe in ghosts, but you have to kind of look at the evidence and say, I don't know what that is or what's happening, such as with the fighter pilots that are up seeing all these craft flying near their craft. So I found it very interesting, you know, in the clip and also, you know, in the past several months, there's been a lot of this coming out as you alluded to, and I'm really interested to see where this goes. And I believe that they could be here, but we don't even know that they're here. They could be walking among us, and in some ways, maybe they don't want to reveal themselves, but we have no idea, you know what their motives would be to be here on Earth or whatever. But it's all very interesting, and as a young kid, I'm 65 years old, and as a young kid, I always thought that would be cool to, to find E.T. But now that it's almost here or possibly here, I'm not sure I wanna come face to face with that yet. So
interesting. That's kind of what I try to go into in the book, you know, and that's one of my characters, Emily, who is very interested in this, the whole career that she built out of it. In the book, she eventually had to set her UFO interest aside just to get a real job, but at some point, proof is going to come whether we like it or not. That's kind of what I feel like. One thing that I always like to point, to talk about is humans had flight, almost 100 years ago, and now we're billionaires are flying up into space like it's no big deal, right?
Yeah.
The way technology can advance so rapidly, who knows what's coming? Maybe we will be able to have those kind of trans-medium ships, within 50 years. You never know.
Sure. Yeah. We are evolving, and that's evidenced of the rich people that have gone into spaces recently, and William Shatner, of course, going up. So that was interesting, kind of a nod to the science fiction kind of genre that we're in, and that was kind of cool. But I've done my research on you a little bit here, and I know that you are also in the area where you live. You're also near Hollywood Studios. What's it like to live near Hollywood Studio?
Oh man, it's not a big deal. It really isn't. Like I thought it would be when I moved to Burbank, I think around 7 years ago, and I pass by the Disney Studios every single day on the way there, which is kind of cool. I worked directly across the street from Warner Brothers. I used to get lunch in their cafeteria every day, but honestly, it's filled with people like you and me. Really. I don't think I've ever seen a celebrity, honestly, working here and living in Burbank. That's really just how it goes. I take that back. I forget his name, but the actor who played the janitor on Scrubs, he's also in a recent sitcom. I forget what it is, but I met him once. I think that's the closest brush with fame I've gotten here.
Neil Flynn,
that's his name.
Yep. And your bio, with a voice you have a voice for radio, I can tell. And your bio says you were a voice actor. What's it like to be a voice actor?
It's lonely. You're by yourself, when you're recording your lines a lot of the time. Mostly I do a lot of audiobooks. That's where I make most of my money. I did a radio play podcast for my other series, which was basically a fully produced radio play. And that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of work too, to be honest, but it was a lot of fun.
That's neat. I wrote that the Rupert Klein character in your Dream Slinger is as diabolical and evilly addicting as any ever written. And I truly believe that. You did a really good job with that. And what's it like getting into your characters' heads? Are you ever scared of what happens in your mind when creating someone like Klein?
No, because it's a character. It's who they are. It's like knowing a bad guy in your life. You know who they are. You're not experiencing their terrible thoughts as them, but you know they have those terrible thoughts, if that makes kind of sense.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of how I build that stuff. That's actually really high praise, honestly, because my biggest thing is villains. I always feel like if you can write a good villain, you can write a good story. Everything else really follows from that.
Uh-huh. And you've also written other books too. Can you talk a little bit about them?
Yeah, actually, I have another series. It is it's called Jim Mead, the Martian PI. This is about a private detective living on Mars, and he somehow always gets caught up into the crazy world-ending events that he has to help prevent with him and his team of friends. And that's actually a series that I'm very, very proud of. I love my Jim Mead series. That's just kind of like the one I want to see become just gigantic. I've got a fourth book coming out, I think, for that series next year.
Go ahead.
No, you're fine. Well, I just was going to say, I also have another series coming. I want to say that's going to be published in spring of 2022. It's called Modern Magic. It's about the reappearance of magic in modern society.
Great. Both of those subjects are really, I'm into. I love the idea of Mars. I really love that. I do a lot of writing about Mars myself. And that's interesting. So I'm going to have to get into your book series there on that. Dive into that one. So do you have a favorite place to go when you write?
Yes. So during the pandemic, I couldn't go. So I didn't get a lot of writing done, unfortunately. But I'm a Starbucks guy. There's a Starbucks in Burbank that's just the perfect place to set up your laptop for a couple hours and really just sit there and write. You just get a view of Olive Avenue, if anybody knows where that is, of all the cars going up and down the street. And, you know, I just hang out there and enjoy, you know, writing. That's my thing. I can also write at home, but it's just not the same. I don't know what it is.
So it's something about being around a crowd of people that might influence your writing a little bit more than being in a room in your house.
You know, I think what it is more for me, honestly, is that when I go to Starbucks or like that, I know I'm going there to write. Whereas when I'm at home, you know, I've got my monitors all set up here. I can have my Word document in front of me and I'm working on it. But then my other monitor will kind of tempt with Netflix or social media or any number of other things. And I'll put that aside. But I kind of feel like when I actually get out and I go sit down and I get my coffee and I have a little Hershey's candy bar, that's the trick, a little treat, you know, that I am in work mode, if that makes sense. It's a lot easier for me to get into work mode, I guess. That's the way to put it.
Yeah. So you also work for a radio station. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know what? I did. I actually just retired. I guess it's not the right word, but I actually just left radio after 20 years. I worked at KFI, which was the largest talk station in Southern California, and actually kind of the nation. They're associated with iHeartMedia, if people know who that is. But I grew up listening to that station. It's very cool. Before that, I was actually I did a morning show radio. So I was part of the wacky morning show antics for a long time. And I have lots of stories from those days that I'll probably have to write another book for.
And what did you do as far as acting wacky?
Oh, you really wanted to? Okay. Well, a couple of highlights from my life. I did a bit called Elevator Idiot, where I would go into an elevator and, you know, one of the long elevator rides, and I would just say the craziest, dumbest stuff to people and record their reaction.
Oh, that sounds like
I'll give you mild versions because we had some pretty crazy ones that I would say that I don't want to say on the air again.
Yeah.
But it would be stuff like, you know, what do you think clouds taste like? And they'd give their answer and I'd say, you're wrong. They taste like marshmallows, but be very over the top and dramatic about it. Like, who is your favorite American Idol? That doesn't work for me, dog. Who do you think invented the question mark? You know, it's really dumb stuff like that. And they were a captive audience. They would get really awkward. And that was my favorite part of the job. One of my favorite bits that I did. And then, you know, I would do other kind of like man on the street type, you know, answer this very simple trivia question, even though you're drunk, that kind of thing. I would do a lot of those types of stuff.
Yeah. Very entertaining.
Yeah, right. Just anything they could do to try and embarrass me or embarrass other people. That's basically what my hosts my bosses were trying to get me to do.
And then you moved into another section of morning radio, or what did you do after that?
Well, I started moving into web production. So I started taking care of the websites and social media for our talk radio station here, KFI. Uh-huh. That's what I've mostly been doing over the last 7 years.
Good, good. Where do you want to see yourself in 5 years? Do you want to see yourself at the top of the bestsellers list, or where would you like to be?
You know, I think more than anything, all I really want is people to read my stuff, whether that's they're buying it or whether they're seeing it on Netflix. That's really the dream. If I get my books onto a TV series or a movie, that has been always been my biggest end goal. And you know, it can happen. And so I figure, why can't it happen to me? That's what
Have you approached anybody in that regard?
I'll put it to you this way. I can't really talk about it at the moment, but I'm in the right position to get my stuff to the right people.
Great.
I hate to be all mysterious and everything, but I actually just – that's kind of the reason why I left radio, is that I moved into a different industry, and now that industry is giving me a kind of some pretty cool options that I'm looking forward to over the next year or so.
Take a walk over to Disney and see what they have to say.
If I walk into Disney's campus right now, I'm pretty sure I'll get arrested. Maybe not in 5 years, but right now, they might get it. Yeah.
You don't want to do that.
No.
Let's see here. How important is cover art to your books? What's the process like to create a book cover? What goes through your mind, and what's the process in that?
So I learned very early on to trust the experts. When I first started self-publishing and doing my own thing, I designed my own covers because I thought, you know, hey, I can do this. No big deal. But the problem is you don't really know what you don't know. So when you're trying to, you know, make a cover, you can try and come up with something. It might look good to you, but in the back of your head, you kind of always know this could totally be better if somebody was trained and could do this. So I eventually started working with cover artists, and that has been a godsend for me, honestly. I always defer to their expert opinion, what they think looks good. I'll give them a basic description, what I think would work, and they run with it. And generally, they always give me great covers. I've never had a problem with it like that.
That's good, like, and I really liked your...
Yeah,
I like your cover with this book here too. I really enjoyed that. So
I'm going to shout her out if you don't mind. Her name's Maria. Maria Savaria. That's her name. Sorry. A beauty book. It's beautbook.com. She's done some excellent, truly excellent work, and I can't thank her enough.
Uh huh. And do you go back and forth with her to get it just right, or is it usually good on the first shot?
I've very, very rarely had to make any kind of updates with her. Like this last book cover for my new series, the only thing I wanted to change was the font for my author name. Everything else just was right on target. And I learned, like I said, you know, my first cover, I was doing papyrus for the book cover font, which is not especially attractive. I mean, that might work for some books, obviously, but it didn't work for Dream Slinger at the time. If you have the resources, invest in a cover artist, because they will pay off in spades.
And I guess that goes hand in hand with having a good editor and possibly a publisher too. It always comes up, of course, of how much am I going to spend on this book that I'm writing. And a lot of authors or new authors that I've talked to through the years don't even consider that. They figure, well, I'll just write it and throw it out there, and I'll proofread it myself, and I'm good at grammar, so that's not a problem. But take it from me. I've made mistakes, and I'm not bad at doing those kind of things. So it's always good to have a good editor. But what's your feelings on on self-publishing and traditional publishing. You are a self-published author, correct?
Well, I'm hybrid now. So Dreamslinger is through Babylon Books. So that makes me the hybrid, which I mean, it works for me. I like it that way because it kind of like relieves a lot of the pressure for me. I still have to do all the marketing, but they'll take care of the editing and the cover, which is nice. For all my self-published stuff, I found people that I want to work with specifically, like Maria, for example, and an editor that I had that I actually discovered through Readsy. Readsy has been a really excellent resource for me to take my books and my writing to the next level.
Yes, and I'm over there on Readsy as a reviewer, so mm-hmm. I would probably at some point I'm going to have somebody from over there to come on our show and talk to us about that process. I think that's very important, especially to first-time authors that we have on our program. It's invaluable to a writer to make sure that their baby that's going out into the world has been dressed properly and acts properly. And believe me, as I said, you know, you put something out there and you think it's great, then you get some critical, you know, people giving you some constructive criticism, and you realize they're right. And it may cost what to have a book edited, probably 100,000 word book. It probably runs you anywhere from $15 to $2,000 for a good edit. So that can be pretty pricey for somebody just starting out, but you know, save those pennies because
it's totally worth it. Cause if you look at my, so I've had my books out, especially the self-published, the Jim Mead Martian PI one, there are a ton of reviews that love the actual story. They think the characters are great, but almost every other review will mention something about, gee, I wish this author could have afforded an editor, you know, because at the time I wrote and published those, I had nothing. I mean, I had no money to my name. I was minimum wage, you know, barely making by at that time. And actually just publishing those books were a way for me to get even just a little bit of extra money coming. But if you ever have the chance to go back and have that kind of stuff re-edited, like you did publish, like you say, and you don't necessarily think you need that editor, trust me, go back, especially if you can afford it now, and get your book re-edited. Because, it just makes everything so much better. And it turns you into a better writer, too, I found.
Right, right. And there are programs out there that you can use now that help you along before you send it off to the editor. I use one. It's ProWriting, and it's a very good program. I think it runs somewhere around $400 what I pay for it, and it gets you through those first steps to at least, you know, get it clean enough where you can get it off to a good editor. Talk to us about Jim Mead. Is he based on Mars, or does he travel back and forth?
He's based on Mars. He actually has a bit of a fear of flying in spaceships, a fear of space. So he tries to keep his boots on the ground on Mars, but of course, I'm always putting him in a tin can and sending him somewhere. So, you know, I've never sent him back to Earth. Earth is not a place that he'll go. In the series. Well, I mean, I shouldn't say ever, but, you know, right now his rule is he's staying put as much as possible.
Right.
I in the second book, I sent him to a large asteroid. The third book, he went to Venus. You know, I just send him wherever he can go. And the next one that I'm publishing next year, he keeps his feet on the ground, which I'm sure he's very grateful for.
And how long has he been up there on Mars? You know, has it been colonized? Oh, he was born there.
He was born on Mars. Yeah. So he's a native born Martian. And I have tech in my book that explains that, you know, the people that live on Mars, they experience a normal Earth gravity, a normal Earth temperature pressure, because they all live in the dome, the lid, as I call it, in the book.
Right.
They just basically lit it off the, Valles Marineris, which is the largest canyon on Mars.
Uh-huh. And I'm sure you probably watched the movie with Matt Damon, Martian.
Yes, absolutely. What a great movie. I loved it. Yeah.
Very, very good. Who are your favorite authors?
Stephen King is the king for a reason. He's definitely my favorite. I'm a big fan of those types of thriller adventure novelists. When I was growing up, I loved reading those lawyer thriller novels. So, you know, Grisham, David Baldacci, William Bernhardt, those guys, I used to go through all his books. And of course, Tolkien. I will reread Lord of the Rings once a year-ish, maybe a little more than that. But I love that series. I think that's great.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah.
Getting back to your book, Dream Slinger, if you could have special powers like the characters are in Dream Slinger, what would be your choice?
Ooh. Well, so the thing about my powers that I give them, so right now in Dream Slinger, we only know of four. There's going to be 12 eventually. But in Dream Slinger, there's the power of healing. There is the power of mind control. There's the power of strength. And there's the power of shape-shifting. And I think out of those, I would go with the power of healing. Just to make me, because I'm paranoid that something might happen and I can't heal, if I get hit by a car or something. I'd like to have that nearby. You know, shape-shifting doesn't sound all that fun to me, but some people might like that one.
Yeah, the shape-shifter in Dream Slinger would have been the female, right? She changes into – yes, I really liked her in that series. Are you ever going to consider bringing you're going to write another book in that series, correct?
Yes, yes. So I know what you were about to say, and I really appreciate that you didn't say that. I appreciate that. But yes, we have five books planned for this series in total. I've got the second one coming out next year, Skyfire. That's going to explore Emily's relationship that she actually has, and a couple other surprises, some new stones as well.
Mm-hmm. If this kind of gets back to what we were originally talking about when we opened up the show, if aliens ever visit Earth, do you see them as being a friend or a foe?
I don't really think it's either. Do scientists consider ants friends or foe? I genuinely think we're nothing more than just kind of like an interesting example of the universe's biological diversity. I don't know if we'll ever be anything more than that, because honestly, we don't know exactly who or what is out there and what they understand, what level of consciousness they have, or how they even experience the universe. If they're silicon-based or carbon-based, if they are in more than just four dimensions, if they're four-dimensional beings or five-dimensional beings, it's really kind of unknown. I mean, if you go back to ancient times, you'll see that a lot of the sightings that come up in stories and legends, most of those sightings were either, demonic or angelic. They were both. So it could be a very well possibility that there are both out there.
Yep, and I think that it's probably a pretty good chance that we'll learn to coexist, as we do, as you mentioned, ants and dolphins and all of the creatures that are populated on this earth. We may end up coexisting with another race from another planet. And maybe
I was going to say, I never anticipate seeing an Independence Day style invasion coming for us or anything like that. I think it's much more mundane than that, honestly.
Right. And there could also be some bad characters, as we have in all kinds of species. You know, some we can get along with, some we can't. So there might be good, and then there might be bad in the mix of whatever the aliens show us to be, whether they look like, a hammer or, some kind of an animal creature or whatever. So I just find it interesting, and I hope I'm around when when that happens, but I hope that it's friendly and not you know, something that we have to fight, because I'm getting too old to do that. So I don't want to do that anymore. But yeah, so it's a little bit difficult when you're getting up there in age to think about those kind of things. But now I'd like to talk to you about reviews. And that's always a good topic to talk about here on the show over the years. The good ones and the bad ones, just like the aliens. How do you deal with those kind of things, the good ones and the bad ones?
I learned a very long time ago that you have to ignore both. Unless they're saying something very specific and they're all echoing the same thing, like something doesn't make sense, or if they're giving you feedback on a character that's either too sexist or too racist or comes off as just tone deaf. I think that kind of stuff you kind of have to pay attention to. But, you know, I've gotten reviews. I've got a 1-star review from somebody on my Jim Mead book that said, I can't share this book, 1-star. And it's like he couldn't share it because of a technical issue he was having. But that doesn't matter, because he gave, you know, he had the problem with my book and gave me a 1-star because of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, I really have just, like I said, if it's something specific about a character that says that it comes off as racist, or if it comes off as tone deaf or whatever, I will absolutely pay attention to that. Everything else is just kind of noise. You just kind of have to let go and hope that your star rating doesn't sink, or even, you know, just or crater or anything like that. Just
right.
Write the best story. All I can really do is write the best story I can, the kind of story that I would want to read, and hope that the world agrees with me. That's it.
Right. And I also have heard from editors and such, and publishers, that it's not so much the good and bad reviews that are important, but it's the quantity of reviews that you get. So obviously,
right,
if you're getting, you know, you're starting off and you've only had the book out there for 2 or 3 months and you're getting 30 to 50 reviews, that's a good thing, even if there's some bad ones mixed in with the good ones. They say that that's more important than the 1-stars or the 5-stars.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Because people are reacting to your book. Absolutely. Because honestly, most people aren't going to sign up and go to Amazon and leave a 1-star review unless they're, one, either extremely motivated or they're a jerk, right? Most people, if they don't like a book, they'll just stop reading it and they don't even care. Like, I think that's the worst part, is if you don't provoke a reaction either way, that's the worst part. And I think that would worry me more than the quantity of reviews. But again, you can't get hung up. I mean, I'd rather be writing. I'm not going to sit here and worry about how many reviews I have for however many, you know, on whatever book I have, because I'd rather be writing. I'd rather be living in my dream slinger world.
Uh-huh. Do you have any regrets about anything that you've written that you would like to have gone back and changed?
You know, nothing problematic, but obviously, when I first started writing and self-publishing books, I had no formal training. You know, I had my AP English from high school and some college level English and stuff like that. So I knew how to write. But actually writing a book is very, very different than writing, you know, a 3-page essay. So when I first started out, I had a lot of what they call head hopping, you know, jumping between characters within chapters, a lot of repeated words, a lot of just those basic rookie mistakes that people make that you don't know about unless you have an editor. So I think if I were to go back, it would be to fix a lot of that stuff. One of my Jim Mead books, Rosetta, has an incredibly long prologue that I really should not have let go on that long. I think it's like 5 chapters almost. It's not full chapters, but they're kind of like the scene separators. It's long. It's way too long, basically. So I'd like to rewrite that for sure. Just take those lessons that I've learned over the last 10 years and just overall improve the quality of the books that I already have written. That's really what I'd want to do.
What about outlines? Do you use outlines, or are you kind of a free-flowing kind of
guy? Oh, yeah. Well, I do a little bit of both. I know this sounds kind of weird, but what happens, I have a very big outline. I call it my Bible of the world, you know, where I talk about locations, the characters within, the, you know, the economy of it, the culture, all those little world-building details. And then for the actual books themselves, I'll use that as a template and go into each book, each character, and all that stuff. I'll do a step outline, which is scene-by-scene breakdown. I'll do a full summary. I'll do character cutouts. And then when I actually start writing, I just write the story in my head that I see. And a lot of times that goes way off from where my outline was. And right. then so I have to kind of redo my outline and then redo my read in my edits. That's usually how that goes.
Do you do it? Do you have an outline that's a program that you use, or do you just get into like a Word program and just do an outline that way?
Yeah.
Or do, what do you do?
I have a Word document that I created for myself, my own kind of template, and I fill that out for every single book. I'm sure there are programs out there that would probably do a better job of that for me, but this is just the system that I relied on for myself over the years, and it's worked for me. And I like it, you know, I like it like that.
Right. Okay, so we're getting down here close to the end of the program, and I'd like to ask, what's next for R.J. Johnson? Where do you see yourself going? I know you're going to work on Dream Slinger, but do you have any other works in the works?
Yeah. Yep, I sure do. I've got a new series coming out. It's called Modern Magic. It's about the reappearance of magic in modern society. I'm really excited about this one because I call this kind of my Avengers novel.
Yep.
My plan is with this series is to have an initial meetup of all of my magic wielding heroes, and then have a series after that of each one book per character kind of thing.
Right.
So I'll have,
I think I saw
my Avengers.
I think I saw your cover for that. We were
yes,
talking about
yes,
covers.
Exactly.
I think I responded to that. I couldn't remember if
yeah.
it was another author or you, but I did see that and I remember it now. Yes, it was a very nice cover. And yeah,
yes.
you were talking about your name in a different font. So yeah, that's very, very nice. And I think covers,
yeah.
getting back to that topic a little bit, that you really should pay attention to covers, because I think that a lot of people, when they see a good-looking cover, their eyes just immediately are drawn to it, and that's what gets them to read it. So,
you know what I'll say, too, real briefly about that as well, is that you want to make sure your covers look good as a thumb as well, like in the shrunk-down version that you see on Amazon as you scroll through, because you don't want
right.
to miss people. If the type is too small or the image is too cluttered or something like that, people would just walk right by. So you want to make sure you're good as both. And that's kind of what I've always aimed for with my covers. That's what I've learned over the last couple of years for sure.
Right. Okay. And looks like we got a little over 7 minutes left of the program. Any parting words that you would like to share, or would you like to thank anyone out there? I know you thanked your cover artist. Anybody else that
yeah.
you would like to thank? This is kind of like the Academy Awards. Now it's your turn to shine.
My time. Oh, man. The now the pressure's on. No, yeah, no.
Yeah.
I actually work with Babylon Books' William Bernhardt. He's been great. He has helped turn my series into something I've never really anticipated. I thought it was just done. But he's helped me republish it and turn it into something truly excellent that I'm really appreciative of. My buddy Rick Ludwig, who is also an author, he has always been a great beta reader, which, by the way, he didn't talk about beta readers much. But those are just as important as any other, you know, covers, editors, or anything like that. Getting,
absolutely.
You know, some real unrestrained opinions on how you're doing or what works and what doesn't work is so important. And so invaluable. You know, you don't want to have somebody that's going to rewrite the book for you. That's not, I don't think, what people are looking for. But if you have somebody that can have a good conversation and understands what you're going for, or understands characters, or just has that basic idea of how to make it work, if you could find somebody like that, hang on to them and use them as much as possible, because they are just such an invaluable resource. I can't recommend that enough. And then, you know, I know this is a writer's podcast, so I'll say this. A lot of people always ask, like, how can I make sure that I, you know, actually write? And I always compared writing to going to the gym. You know, at first it kind of is a little bit of resistance to it. You don't really know what you're doing or anything like that. But once you do it enough, you really start building those writing muscles. You kind of crave it. You kind of want to get whatever project you're on done, or you want to start a new project. And, you know, I've always been a fan of, you know, creating that routine, a daily routine that makes sure that you sit down, you're writing for however much your goals are, and you try to knock that out every day. And if you do that, you really will have all the content you could ever want, honestly.
Right, right. Okay, and where can we find you? I know that's a question that came up a lot in the beginning of the internet, in the beginning of the show about 10 years ago. Now, basically, it's just go to Amazon and look for me on Amazon. But some people have their own websites that they like people to go to. And where would you direct people to go to if they'd like to buy Dreamslinger or any number of your other books?
Well, if they want to, they can always go to rickertherwriter.com, Ricker, R-I-C-K-E-R, thewriter.com. And actually, I'll give everybody that signs up for my mailing list the first book in my Jim Mead series. So just go directly there, sign up for my newsletter, and I'll send you a little link that says, hey, here, download Change in Management. That's genuinely my favorite book. I actually won an award for that one when I first published that. I'm very proud of that series, and so I just want as many people to read it as possible.
Very good. And I failed to mention that you have won awards with your writing.
Oh, yeah.
So
yes,
that's,
I won 2013 that Sci-Fi Fantasy Best Published with Change in Management.
Yes. And maybe someday you'll be up there hoisting the Oscar above your head if somebody takes up your movie.
I'd take an MTV movie award, honestly. I'll take whatever.
Those Oscars, I am told, they're very heavy to lift. They look a lot lighter than they actually are. They're pretty hefty.
What a problem to have, I'll tell you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. RJ, it's been a pleasure, and I'm going to start reading your Martian book there and find out what he's all about. I can't wait to get back onto Mars, and I'd love to be able to go there someday. But I can't, so I'll do it through a book, and I'll start off with your book. There's a lot of books on Mars out there, and that'll be a pleasure for me. But thank you so much for being on the show, and we'll let you get back to your busy life. And if you see Mickey Mouse wandering around there near the studio, and you know, say hello to him and be nice to him.
I'll do that. Thank you so much, Tom. This has been a real fun time. I appreciate it.
Take care.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye bye. Okay, there goes RJ and his book again, Dreamslinger. So go ahead and take a look at that on Amazon or any of your booksellers that are out there. And now going on to the last segment of the show is Final Chapter on Monday, November 29th, in 2 weeks at 7 p.m., we will have on our show Nancy Kilgore and her book Bitter Magic, inspired by the true story of confessed witch Isabel Gowdy. It's a journey back to the 17th century Scotland. So until then, see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and eyes to the page and to let the story. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and good night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. Of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world you make.